You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 18th of December 2025 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, it's Thursday today, so we will be looking at geopolitics with the company of my esteemed co-host, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, who is also the senior researcher at thebarnesreview.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm telling you, this has been one hell of a year. I never thought I'd live to see the day. So much is going on. It's really extraordinary. And the fact that I'm doing this with you, I still can't get over that. It's such a bizarre notion that, it blows my mind.
Well, I'm very pleased to be back. And we do indeed live in strange times. Lots of things I never thought I would actually see. I have seen some of the things that the US State Department have been saying about the threat to democracy, which is actually censorship in Europe, and mass immigration is a threat to Western civilization. I never thought I would hear these things being said. We live in hope that they will actually do something about it, as well as talk about these issues. But I mean, that is a big shock to the system for me. And it's something that I'm very pleased about. But to get onto the topic we're going to be talking about today, we're using an article by somebody called Drago Bosnick. I am guessing he's possibly Bosnian. And the article is titled, "The British Are No Longer a Major Power," and it concerns the British Navy. In its heyday, the United Kingdom was by far one of the most powerful empires in human history, probably eclipsed only by the United States in the latter half of the 20th century. By the early 1920s, it managed to occupy and enslave approximately 25% of the planet's landmass and population, over 35 million kilometres and around 450 million people, respectively. How did a relatively small island nation accomplish this? The answer is the British Navy, the most powerful armed maritime force of its time. Thus, it could only be expected that London would do everything in its power to preserve this naval dominance for as long as possible. And I wanted to pause here because I don't think it was just the British Navy that enabled this. If you look at the time of the start of the British Empire, the Jews had just come back into Britain. And the central banking system, the Bank of England, had just been set up. And in return for that, the Jews lent Britain a lot of money. And I think that had just as much to do with this as well as the British Navy. It was, and I'm not sure, but fractional reserve banking may have even been used at this time. I know they would have lent out a lot more than they actually had in deposits. And I think this also added to the start of the British Empire, was the fact that they could access this money, which they couldn't really do before. Otherwise, it's just a strange coincidence that just at the same time we had the Bank of England setting up. And also, I believe prior to that, the Jews were in Holland, and that's where you get the Dutch East India Company from, that sort of appeared before the British Empire. Have you got any thoughts on that, Matt? Do you think I'm correct in saying that?
Oh, I think it's an oversimplification, but I think he's just saying it for dramatic effect here. I mean, this is how things were enforced. Their power was enforced by the Navy. That was the one thing that made them superior to most others. Britain is so small. They didn't have the infantry for it. It was a classic Atlantean sea power, and therefore it was completely dependent on its navy. But I think you're absolutely right. The British East India Company, the Dutch, etc., these were either Rothschild or Sassoon properties. Had as much to do with it as anything else. But in terms of enforcement, yes, it's the navy.
Of course, British sea power is what you think of as soon as you think of the word sea power, isn't it?
Yeah.
Carrying on with the quotes here. However, as the British Empire shrank to a mere shadow of its former self, its ability to maintain a large navy dwindled, resulting in massive reductions over the last several decades. The last time the United Kingdom managed to muster a respectable naval force was during the 1982 Falklands War against Argentina. Ever since, the British Navy has been fading away, reducing both the quantity and the quality of its ships. According to various reports over the last 20 years, London now has nearly twice as many admirals as it does actual warships. Worse yet, many of those formerly combat-capable vessels are in such a dilapidated condition that they are barely usable as ships, much less as warships. This ranges from frigates and destroyers to aircraft carriers and submarines, including nuclear-powered ones. However, while the surface fleet is undoubtedly still relevant, it is nowhere near as important as the British Navy's underwater component, which provides the most critical segment of the United Kingdom's strategic power projection, namely the Vanguard-class SSBNs, nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines, armed with UGM-133A Trident II, also known as Trident D5, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs. They are the cornerstone of London's thermonuclear arsenal. But it seems this is not enough for the perfidious Albion to take them seriously. Rear Admiral Philip Matthias recently lamented that Britain is no longer capable of running a capable nuclear submarine program, warning of catastrophic failures that have driven the United Kingdom's nuclear deterrent to the brink. Matthias, who served as a Director of Nuclear Policy at the British Ministry of Defence, the MOD, highlighted its inability to produce attack submarines at the scale required for putting strain on crews and extending the length of deployments. He compared this to the First Cold War, stressing that the silent service could deploy for around 70 days at the time, but that this has risen to around 200 days at present. So, I mean, on the face of it, that seems like an improvement to me, that they used to be able to stay underwater for 70 days and now they can for 200 days. But he's clearly pointing out some failures in the rest of this here, this Matthias, who works for the MOD. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I have, if you go to my Patreon page, I have numerous articles on the American military, and they follow the same trajectory as what he's talking about here. Bosnich is a specialist in military hardware, so he loves bringing up all these names, and I actually rely on him a lot in my new book as to why the Russians can't be defeated today. Now the thing about the submarines are fairly inexpensive when you consider a destroyer or an aircraft carrier. But a nuclear arsenal isn't just about being able to shoot them. It's about being able to maintain them over time. And both the U.S. and Britain have allowed their stocks to kind of, they're not being taken care of the way they should be. And I also want to say, and I've said this, it's also on my Patreon page, come to think of it, that the British lost in Argentina. I actually list the losses between both parties. There's a very specific reason as to why the Argentinians bowed out. But the British, and I quote a whole bunch of officers saying that they were on the verge of total extinction. But the point is, they're both the U.S. and the U.K. The surface ships are dwindling. They're not being maintained the way they should, and training is not being, and you also don't have the level of manpower that you used to have many years ago to be able to, that's not the case in the East though. Be able to really pursue any kind of power projection. Now, and the reason he's saying this is that, you know, the British are threatening, you know, the Chinese and the Russians at the same time. And the truth is, clearly, they don't have this capacity. They couldn't do it. And so the underwater aspect of the Navy, it's because it's relatively inexpensive, it's something that can be pursued.
Well, it also seems like they have at least twice as many admirals as they do actually have ships. I mean, that's one of the bits that really sort of struck me there. Getting back to the article here, Matthias quoted the recent Strategic Defence Review, the SDR, which stressed the need to expand production capacity. He warned that policymakers need to change course, even calling for the United Kingdom's withdrawal from AUKUS. It could be argued that Matthias doesn't want London to get involved in any China containment policies while its navy effectively falls apart. However, the UK seems to be determined to escalate tensions with both Eurasian giants. This includes challenging China over Taiwan and prolonging the NATO-orchestrated Ukrainian conflict by directly and openly threatening Russia with a plan to, quote, choke Crimea to death. And I wanted to pause there because that's the first time I'd actually heard that phrase, choke Crimea to death. What is he referring to there, and who said that, and what was the policy that would have done that Britain was suggesting to do?
Well, all the Western powers, for some reason, believe that the Crimea is non-Russian, shouldn't be there. Is not a part of the Russian Federation. And the actual phrase choking Crimea to death is an odd one. The Americans and the Ukrainians there have engaged in terrorism against the Crimean population. I have a whole bunch of examples of that in my book. But, you know, I have yet to hear a single rational policy reason for this obsession over either Russia or China. You know, the idea that Russia is going to invade the Baltics, Poland, is absurd. And sometimes even the U.S., it gets even worse than that. Certainly Britain's AUKUS, by the way, I should mention is, Australia, the UK, and the US, hence the initials. And again, that's a huge commitment. And when you're already overstretched, I mean, the US is overstretched isn't even the right word anymore. You know, it's coming apart at the seams. Trying to provoke, I mean, actually, me and you, I've gone over this many times. The attempts to provoke a Russian attack on an American, either a plane or a ship, but by both sides, or Russia and China, and they've wisely, you know, not done that. And every month there seems to be a new example. But choke Crimea to death. I guess, you know, it clearly has something to do with sanctions. They voted, 94% to go with Russia. I think today it would be 100%. No one wants to be a part of the fourth world Ukrainian failed state. But I also think, too, Crimea is more symbolic than anything else. You know, you have no right to do this stuff. Well, we cannot.
Continuing with the article here, it should be noted that problems with the British Navy's SSBN component are nothing new. Namely, back in February 2024, many authors questioned whether the United Kingdom's strategic arsenal was functioning properly. Although such information is certainly a state secret, these doubts were confirmed after London admitted that one of its UGM-133A Trident II SLBMs failed during a launch test. According to the British media, this was the second time in a row that the troubled missile, a weapon of strategic importance, failed, as was the case with the previous test, conducted back in 2016. The last successful launch was actually performed by HMS Vigilant all the way back in 2012. This means the United Kingdom hasn't had a successful SLBM test in nearly a decade and a half, yet it still believes it can go up against Russia, a country with the world's largest and most powerful strategic arsenal. The latest Trident II launch was from the lead ship of its class, the HMS Vanguard, with reports indicating that London's then-Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, was overseeing it. The SLBM's booster rocket failed, and it fell into the sea close to the launch site, as The Sun reported at the time, with the launch site being the Vanguard itself. And yet, Shapps insisted that he has absolute confidence in Trident's submarines, missiles, and nuclear warheads. And that sort of reminds me of, I know it's a different subject altogether, but it reminds me of recently with Donald Trump and the BBC, and the BBC doctored his speech, stitched two speeches together to make him say something that he hadn't said. And when they were talking about this in the Houses of Parliament, they were saying, oh, the BBC is so important because it in all this fake news that's around, we have to have the BBC because it's a beacon of truth. And it's like they just didn't seem to understand. It was the BBC itself that was creating the fake news, and they just didn't get it. And it's the same thing here, isn't it? The missile has literally crashed in the water just right by the actual ship that it was being fired from, and you've got Grant Shapps saying he has absolute confidence in the submarines, missiles, and nuclear warheads. I mean, what do you make of this, Matt? You must know more about it than I guess than what he says here.
Well, again, I've mentioned that, you know, it's all about the maintenance and having the manpower and the ability, the intellectual ability, to keep these things in good shape, which is actually kind of a big deal. And clearly they don't. And this is the proof of it. I guarantee you most Americans don't know that. But amongst people who do on both sides of the Atlantic, it's very hard for those who believe in the empire to accept the fact that they simply are not major, they're not major powers anymore. Not because there's anything wrong with them, because this is their own policies that have destroyed that have destroyed their capacity in this regard. They like to project a lot onto North Korea. So anytime there's a failed missile test, they'll play it a million times in the news. But here, you know, something as simple as a submarine launch is what, you know, SSBN means. Submarine ballistic missile is something that they struggle with. That means that the incompetence, that the problems are deeper than even any of us know. And that the point, of course, being that who are they then to claim to be able to choke off Crimea to threaten the Russians or the Chinese?
That's puffing the chest out, all mouth and no trousers, isn't it, basically? Continuing here, as previously mentioned, London relies solely on the submarines and missiles for its strategic capabilities. Had the Trident II damaged the HMS Vanguard, it would have taken one quarter of the United Kingdom's strategic arsenal out of service. As the perfidious Albion has only four vessels, such armed with up to 16 SLBMs. It should also be noted that the Vanguard finished an overhaul over 7 years and refueling just last year. However, to make matters even worse, both Shapps and the then head of the Royal Navy, now disgraced Admiral Ben Kay, were on board the submarine during the launch test, meaning that their lives were actually put in danger. The failures are also an embarrassment for the United States, as the missiles are manufactured by Lockheed Martin, the Pentagon's premier military supplier, Still, all this didn't prevent Shapps from adding to the general embarrassment by saying that an anomaly did occur during the test on 30th of January 2024, but that the Trident II SLBM is still the most reliable weapon system in the world. According to his assessment, the test reaffirmed the effectiveness of the UK's nuclear deterrent and that the anomaly was event-specific, with no implications for the reliability of the UK's strategic arsenal. The British Ministry of Defence made similar statements. Namely, it insisted that HMS Vanguard and its crew had been proven fully capable in their operations and that the test had reaffirmed the effectiveness of the UK's nuclear deterrent, essentially repeating Shapps' statement that Trident II is the most reliable weapon system in the world. These sorts of dangerous self-delusions show just how out of touch the political West is when it comes to its assessments of starting a thermonuclear war against not one, but multiple global and regional superpowers, be it Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea, with the latter often being the first target of Western propaganda and ridicule. But its strategic arsenal has proven that it works flawlessly. And I do remember them pointing out these failed missile tests in North Korea, but I don't recall anything being said about this, this missile test that failed. And it seems they already had it written out what the quotes were going to be, expecting the missile test to work, and it didn't work. And instead of adjusting their quotes, they just came out with the same stuff, say that it was the most reliable weapon system in the world, but it's not reliable if it doesn't fire, does it? And what they're saying here is twice since then, like it hasn't actually worked. Matt, what do you make of this?
I have a paper on Patreon on the U.S. Navy. It's very similar, where the accidents, the crashes, they should not have ever happened, are constant and regular, and they're getting a lot of people angry around because this is around the world, of course, not just surface ships but submarines too. I think you're right that. They had this in advance, and they saw, because they're just talking heads, they, you know, what a politician is, they just uttered it. But also because they have a tough time dealing with it. There is a psychological element here that, you know, Americans, especially, but the British too, they can't handle the fact that they can't do what they used to do. And I don't know about I've never looked into in depth in the UK Navy as I have the US Navy. But in both cases, it's really a litany of disasters. Their lives were in danger. And I guarantee you the high command of Russia and China were well aware of these accidents. So. I'm trying to say, well, event specific, meaning it's just, there's nothing wrong with us. It was just this one time. And clearly that's not the case. And that was just last year. We're talking about 2024 here. So, they're in no position to threaten major powers, superpowers throughout the world.
Well, we're actually going to go back to 2024 for the next article, and it's by the same author, Drago Bosnick, from February 9th, 2024. He says, on February the 6th, The Telegraph, one of the oldest publications in the United Kingdom, ran a story about the supposed inability of Russia to deal with Europe without the United States. According to the author, Andrew Lillico, even if Washington DC pulled out of the old continent, Putin would be crazy to start something. Lillico claims that the Russian economy is fairly small, only around 85% of the size of Italy's, and that its population of about 140 million is less than that of Germany plus France combined. Using the nominal GDP to measure economic power can be described as either functional illiteracy or mere propaganda. The idea that Italian and Russian economies are not only comparable, but that the former is 15% larger is simply ludicrous. In addition, the claim that Russia's population is only about 140 million is false, as the latest data shows that the Eurasian giant has over 147 million people, which also includes the Crimean Peninsula, but actually excludes the four former Ukrainian regions that joined it on September 30th, 2022. Those additional areas push Russia's population well over 150 million, meaning that the claim that it has a smaller population than France and Germany combined is also false. Lilico then goes on to parrot debunked propaganda tropes about Moscow's supposed inability to defeat Ukraine, a country that when Russia invaded was the world's 53rd largest economy, below New Zealand and Peru. Once again, the author's premise is based on the deeply flawed nominal GDP data, which while he completely ignores the fact that the Kiev regime is an extremely militarized entity. Data on its armed forces shows that if Kiev was officially in NATO, it would have been among its top three members in terms of conventional military power. And yet its casualty ratio against the Russian military is around 20 to 1 in Moscow's favor. Now, I would sort of point out there that maybe this author might be a little bit biased. Where is he getting his figures from that it's 20 to 1 in Moscow's favor? He's probably getting those figures from Russia. And of course, we in the West, we are being given figures that are favoring Ukraine, saying that Russia is the one that is actually losing in this war. So where do you get your figures from, Matt? Where do you get your, where would you say was the most accurate place to get the figures from for this?
Well, you know, it isn't just a matter of the academic literature. Whether it be Russian or Western, but I've also gone to a few other places. I've read, you know, military blogs. I could read the language okay. The statements by soldiers themselves. The nature of the Russian advance, you know, actually what they want to do. There's a lot of defense publications that have agreed with him in English, and I cite all of those. So there's a whole bunch of them, and you have to know how to put them all together into some kind of coherent narrative. You know, because Ukraine already had a third world economy, which is just a crime in and of itself. Weapon systems don't matter. I don't care how many weapons you give Ghana. You know, they're not going to be a regional power because they don't have the economic background or foundation to use them. These are expensive. These require educated men to operate, and they have to have a full training program. These have to be completely integrated with every other aspect of their economy. And I think I used the example of Ghana before. You can throw all the weapons you want at Ghana. If they don't have any trained men, what are they going to do with it? And that's essentially what it is. And it doesn't matter anymore anyway, because, you know, these things get vaporized the minute they show up. Because Russia has every square centimeter of that country under surveillance. Now about NATO, the question is, if Ukraine was to join NATO, they would have to completely standardize their military forces with the U.S., the British, etc. That would cost billions and billions of dollars that Ukraine doesn't have. That's why it's kind of a nonsensical concept. What I've been saying from the beginning, you know, although my predictions tend to come true on these things, but Lilico is an economist. He's not connected with Russia studies whatsoever. He's using, you know, just Western sources, Western liberal sources. You know, in other words, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, for his information, as if that's the place to go to. But I think that last comment is incorrect. You have a third world economy, but rather than build that economy up No, they only cared about building up its military so it can be used against Russia. That's the only use Ukraine has. Like Kosovo used to be, or Albania used to be. Yeah, building them up against Serbia. The casualty figures, and the casualty figures, I have a whole chapter in my book as to where you go. There's a million places, everything from obituaries to letters written from the mothers of veterans. There's so many places to go to, so many variables put together, how many have actually died. And not to mention, I think we know now, given the Russian hack of Ukrainian Department of Defense, we're dealing with almost 2 million dead, which was even more than I had said in the past. And that information has not been, they didn't deny it, hasn't been debunked or anything else. There's been no attack on it. All those documents that they had were made public, and then that was pretty much the end of it. Hoping that the media would just, the Western media, of course, is going to shut that down. But I read it. It makes a certain amount of sense to me. Not to mention the fact when you talk about Ukraine losses. Remember, they're paying for, actually we're paying for, mercenaries from around the world. I have one friend of mine who had to go to Kiev for something, unrelated to all of this. And he went to Warsaw and he took the train in, and he said every single person was a mercenary heading to the war. They're from all over the world. So how many of these people are actual, Ukrainians? How many of these, their command structure collapsed pretty early. And Putin never really wanted this. He didn't want to kill Orthodox Christian men. So, extremely militarized entity. Well, that's the choice that the West made. Again, with a third world economy, that's all they cared about was making it into a battering ram against Russia. Ukraine has nothing that the Western world can't make themselves, economically speaking, and certainly not in the agricultural department. All you have is there's some experiments being done in the black soil regions. Can you believe this? Of course, all the bio labs we know about in great detail. That's how they're repaying their debt, trillions of dollars, well, maybe not trillions, high billions from the IMF, trying to bail them out year after year after year after year, knowing they wouldn't see their money again. I've been talking about this so long, at least from 2004, that Orange Revolution. And many of these weapons systems, remember, also go on the black market. Because you're starting to see brand new American weapons being used in civil wars in Congo, Syria, whatever. So Lilico just goes to whatever the dominant sources happen to be. I want to go to everyone. There's a few sources. I know a few people who I've contacted. Again, the soldiers' blogs are very interesting. I like them a lot. They say more than they should say, I think. So there's a lot going on here, but he's not going to do that. He just simply wants to promote himself. He's an academic in a major institution. I forget what it is. It certainly has nothing to do with anything military or Eastern European. But you could see why I would put these two articles together, right? The first, the UK Navy falling apart. The second is this idiot saying that Putin would be crazy to start anything with them. We could say the same thing about Germany or France. their weapon systems have been disastrous in Ukraine. The only kind of victory they ever had in Ukraine was using the old Soviet models of things, which even surprised me. So this war is almost unprecedented in how it's being fought, and it was lost in April of 2022, but they just keep going. They don't care. They know that Ukraine can't win, not in a billion years. But maybe because it'll do some damage to Russia, it's justified. It's Ukraine is being depopulated, and it is a crime, and it's something that really, and you have these so-called Ukrainian nationalists waving a stupid flag, all these people on CNN pointing at maps. They'd never heard of these places before, but all of a sudden they've heard of them. You know, Donetsk and Luhansk and Odessa, with some authority. You know, they don't know the Kursk incursion and all that. It's simple propaganda, in the sense that propaganda, almost by definition, has to be false.
No, just referring to the mercenaries there, I think they found British soldiers there this week. British soldiers have died over there, and it's a bit of a mystery what they were doing over there on the front lines. Getting back to the article here, if such an atrocious performance of the Kievan forces against the Russian military is a defeat for the Kremlin, it really makes you wonder what a victory would look like. However, Lidiko still insists that Kiev is winning. What's more, he further claims that even if the US leaves, the EU and the UK could easily defeat Russia. Interestingly, at one point, even the author himself implies that having a higher GDP does not imply being more militarily powerful. While this is certainly true, Lidiko's admission is simply an attempt to justify his flawed logic on why Italy has a supposedly larger economy, but only a fraction of Russia's military might. The author then tries to analyse how a potential conflict would play out precisely on this false premise of Moscow's fairly small economy, which in reality is the fifth largest in the world. And I believe you wanted me to stop there, Matt. You wanted to explain something here.
Yeah. Russia is the fourth largest economy in the world. It's also a very diverse economy. I have another paper, because this is all I do all day long, because I'm a lunatic. Things concerning oil and gas come down to maybe 10% of the economic growth in Russia today. A lot more in the exports, but not domestically. It's a very complicated. There's even a list of a measure of complex economies, complexity. Russia is now the fourth largest. If you use the proper purchasing power parity, now he mentioned the nominal GDP. And he's saying that that's an error. He doesn't explain why that's an error. Purchasing power parity tries to understand, if a dollar a day in America is nothing, a dollar a day in North Korea is probably a lot. PPP takes that into account. You know, all of these maudlin people talk about African poverty. They live on 50 cents a day. Well, is that a lot or a little? It depends on everything else. What's subsidized? What isn't? Purchasing power parity takes all of that into account. So usually when you look things up in terms of GDP, you have the nominal and the PPP, and they're usually very, very different. PPP takes, it's a relative term. Let's say the Japanese, for some reason, the yen loses half its value overnight. Does that mean the economy is half gone? No, it just means that some manipulation of the bankers made the currency collapse.
Well, Illico then goes on to parrot other ludicrous claims, such as the idea that an authoritarian state might be able to conscript more of its population to fight, but it might also have what we might term a morale disadvantage. Its forces might become unable or unwilling to fight at a lower loss rate than would be the case for forces fighting for what they regard as a more noble cause. This premise shows the author's complete lack of understanding of Russia and its military traditions that have been largely preserved, unlike in the political West, where service in the military is increasingly unpopular. Even Lilico himself admits that Western societies have become sufficiently self-hating or decadent that they do not regard their own cause as noble enough to fight for, meaning that they would not have a higher morale. This inaccurately postulated analysis then becomes even worse as the author claims that the Russian economy is about 10% of the size of the European Union's. And you wanted to make a point there as well, Matt.
Well, yeah, it's absurd because he uses only the nominal GDP measures. It's much higher than that if you use purchasing power parity. That's all I wanted to say.
Once again, based on this false premise, Lilico pushes another one. Namely, he claims that based on the percentage of military spending in both the European Union and Russia, the latter would need to mobilize more than 40% more troops than the former. Thus, to match 1.4 million European Union troops, Russia would supposedly need around 2 million soldiers, or 3 million if it decided to invade. Thinking that a modern conflict is about the number of troops shows just how little understanding of military power and doctrine that this author has. The very idea that Moscow would send millions of men to invade Europe is beyond ridiculous. If Russia ever had to deal with the EU military, it would need zero invasion troops, the reason being very simple. Russian long-range strike systems completely negate the need to send any ground troops to any European country. Its cruise missiles, particularly the Kalibr family, would devastate EU air bases long before any large fighter jet squadrons could be mustered to launch strikes within Russia. Moscow's ballistic and hypersonic missiles would neutralize any large formations of EU ground forces, while its massive and rapidly expanding fleet of strike drones would pick off any leftover units. The EU's military-industrial capacity would also be targeted from thousands of kilometers away, as Russia has the world's second-largest fleet of strategic bomber missile carriers that would easily launch hundreds of cruise missiles. So, I mean, basically, they're not they don't understand the technology that's involved here. For this author to think that it's going to need lots of soldiers, Russia has technology so that it doesn't actually need lots of soldiers. But I would point out where it says that Russia has the world's second largest fleet of strategic bomber missile carriers, I would imagine that America has the world's largest fleet. So, I mean, there is a balance of power here. It's just that we're used to seeing what's happening in Ukraine, and we're taught to think that it would be the same techniques that would be used if Russia was tried to go into the European Union. But it wouldn't. They could just use their missiles. They wouldn't be bothering trying to minimize casualties like they are in Russia. I mean, what do you make of this bit, Matt?
Well, there's so much to cover here. One of the theses of my book, and I lean very heavily on Bosnitz here, because he's the military technician, given the fact that the Russians have hypersonic missiles and the West does not, gives the Russians a huge advantage. And, of course, the Chinese, North Koreans, but it's of Russian design. Russia has, as of right now, is absolutely invincible militarily. It can produce whatever it wants. It has all the resources locally. It has a battle-hardened military force. And its military-industrial complex is state-owned. Rather than in the U.S., it's a for-profit corporation where they're spread out everywhere, you know, because they outsource to the third world. I don't think, you know, 1.4 million EU troops, where are they getting that from? That's impossible. They couldn't get that many. Or supply that many. You know, Western Europe is completely demilitarized. I go through a whole list of things. You know, Drew, you used to talk about German engineering, and so many of the German tanks and armored personnel carriers have come off the mass production scheme have been absolutely disastrous. Most of them don't work anymore. And I'm not sure if it's the U.S. that has the first or Chinese have the first. I didn't look that up, actually. We talked about the in terms of the drones. But this man lives in absolute fantasy land, or he lives in a world where everything is purely quantitative. He doesn't understand quality. You know, what happened was, in the beginning, of course, Ukraine was planning on invading the Donbas. This is what provoked the Russian invasion. Now, in the beginning, because there were a few glitches in the system, in the Russian system, which is why they struggled a bit. But those are all gone. You have experience. Everyone in Russia now is experienced in combat and in using these high-tech weapons on a regular basis. But the U.S. certainly isn't. But you know, this guy is just putting in numbers in either a regression analysis or a computer otherwise, and thinking that's the fact of the matter. Russia has no interest in invading Central Europe. They couldn't hold it. If they did, what would be the point of it? But he's absolutely right. And I go through again using Bosnich as a crutch there for a while, because he knows a tremendous amount about this, about how it's not just the Caliber family, but all the Russian missile families could be if the West would attempt to mobilize, they would be completely destroyed before they even got off the ground. Hypersonic missiles can't be defended against. There's a lot here that I went into, in my book, but it's that this guy believes it and he's promoting it is worrisome, because then it may lead a policymaker to say, let's keep the war going.
In other words, the Kremlin wouldn't wage war in the way Lilico imagines. It's not World War I or World War II, where millions of soldiers are needed to inflict a strategic defeat on an enemy. It's important to note that Russia could accomplish all this through conventional means only, and some of the top former American generals already confirmed this, explaining that the entire NATO would be unable to match this without resorting to thermonuclear war. Yet even in that case, Moscow would have an advantage, as it possesses an unrivaled strategic arsenal, composed of monstrosities such as the RS-28 Sarmat. However, Lilico ignores all of this and concludes his analysis with a claim that Russia is supposedly losing hundreds of billions of dollars due to Western sanctions, and that this allegedly undercuts Russian military power. In his closing remarks, the author claims that Moscow cannot threaten the EU, let alone Britain. Deep-seated in his reality bubble, Lilico believes that the UK is more of a threat to Russia than even the EU. In the meantime, London is going through one humiliation after another, as the very cornerstone of its military power projection capabilities, the Royal Navy, is in disarray. Its aircraft carriers are breaking down, while the destroyers are in no better condition. Although the data is certainly a state secret, given the horrible state of the most important branch of the UK's military, it is highly questionable whether London's strategic arsenal is functioning as it should. Thus, it would be extremely unwise for the perfidious Albion to keep poking the Russian bear. And I think you've demonstrated that very well here today, Matt, with these two articles here and your comments on them. What are your closing words today?
Well, it seems that the regime, that is to say the Western ruling classes, the people who hate us, they really thrive on warfare. Warfare allows them to do whatever they want to do. including censorship and everything else. I know that in the EU, RT and Sputnik are banned. Clearly, they're frightened about something. Even though these are mostly independent news sources, and it seems that every other day, Russia's coming out with a new missile type. And I also have an article on all the American failures, the Zumwalt failure and a few others, trying to build new weapons. They just, it's a matter of focus. It's a matter of nationalism. I mean, who in Ukraine wants to fight for this completely Jewish ruling class that is not Ukrainian, that holds all the money? Well, they have nothing. Who wants to fight for these people? And that's, this is what it all comes down to. It, and it's a punishment. You know, if you say something wrong in Ukraine, of course, you have martial law. You have four parties that all say the exact same thing. So it's a one-party state. You say something wrong, draft is your number one. People are being dragged off of buses to get sent to the draft. You have untrained men at the front. Russia is a standing humiliation. I should say, mention China too. It's a standing humiliation to the Western world. Because it's illiberal, and yet has succeeded economically, and the sanctions have, after a short period of time, been nothing but a boon to the Russian economy. They've built new ties with Turkey and India, increased what they had with China, North Korea, everybody. You know, especially in the East, where the growth is really happening. So why in heaven's name would Russia ever want to renegotiate with the West, go back to the G8 or whatever? They get nothing out of it. Russia is one of the few countries in the world that is completely autarkic, or could be autarkic. In other words, it has everything it needs to function. When it kicks out a Western, or they have to pull out because of the sanctions, Western producer, someone like McDonald's. Oh boy, what are they going to do without McDonald's? Their new Russian investors come in and take care of that problem. It's taken a while, but now they have a completely Russian-based economy, not one based on globalism. And the fact that it's continuing to do relatively well under the circumstances, the West just lies about its economic statistics, but. And the Putin's popularity continues to be fairly high. A lot of this stuff has a lot to do with projection. When he tried to say, Lilico tried to say something about the morale of the Russian soldiers, that is pure projection. And the big issue, Russia's aims in this war were very limited. It didn't want to take Kiev. It didn't want to destroy Ukrainian power stations, which were built by Russia in the first place, although they've been forced to do it. That was not the issue. They just wanted a non-NATO, non-EU, neutral, kind of like what Finland and Austria were during the Cold War. That's what they thought, what they sought, and pretty much an independent East. They're all Russian-speaking anyway. They have nothing to do with Kiev. So, that's what this war was. And had the Russians not invaded, the Donbas would have been slaughtered. And that includes the people in the Crimea. And that's why this war exists in the first place. The West started it. And finally, Jens Stoltenberg, the former head of NATO, admitted this a few years ago.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you with Grandpa Dan as my co-host. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.